From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Tax cuts, health care, Iraq. In the second presidential debate, Senators Barack Obama and John McCain faced a town hall audience and tried to get their jabs in without seeming mean.
Senator Obama's secret that you don't know is that his tax increases will increase taxes on 50% of small business revenue.
He says that he's going to give you a $5,000 tax credit. What he doesn't tell you is that he is going to tax your employer-based health care benefits for the first time ever. So what one hand giveth, the other hand taketh away.
With a big picture for us, we've got Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Ron Christie, a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. He's also the president and founder of Christie Strategies. Hi, folks.
Nice to be with you both.
Hello, Farai.
So, what was the moment that crystallized how well, let's say, Senator Obama was performing for you? And by that, I mean, pick out something you like about what Senator Obama said. Ron.
Well, I think Senator Obama did not go on the attack like many people had expected him to last night. David Axelrod, his campaign manager, said that he was bracing for a very negative fight, and we didn't see that. And I think that there was some unity between the two candidates as it related to finding a way to deal with a financial crisis that's not only gripping the United States, but also impacting markets in Asia and Europe and around the world. So from that standpoint, I think that that was something good that Senator Obama had to say. But other than that, as it relates to his policies, Farai and Mary, you know I'm really not going to agree with him on much.
All right, Mary, I'm going to ask you to reach across the aisle and say something good about what McCain's approach was or what he communicated.
Well, I guess the best moment for McCain was when he embraced the idea of having the federal government buy up the mortgages of homeowners who have been foreclosed and then to give them new terms, and embracing that idea, which is very popular with the broader public, according to opinion polls, and who don't like the idea of bailouts for Wall Street, but do like something for local people. That was his best moment in the entire debate. But beyond that, he had a lot of very bad moments indeed.
Okay. Both of you are holding back just a little. I want to get into some of the moments that made the night. There was one that came right at the top. There were, you know, I'd gotten a YouTube video sent to me from someone, and then an hour later, basically people were hearing about this all across the country. What I'm talking about is during a hearing on Capitol Hill yesterday, U.S. Representative Elijah Cummings tore into AIG executives for spending over $400,000 on a spa retreat after the bailout. Let's listen.
AIG spent, listen to this one, $23,000 at the hotel spa and another $1,400 at the salon. They were getting their manicures, their facials, their pedicures, and their massages, while American people were footing the bill.
Senator Obama took that on in the debate.
And in fact, we just found out that AIG, a company that got a bailout, just a week after they got help, went on a $400,000 junket. And I tell you what, the Treasury should demand that money back, and those executives should be fired.
Ron, this is a red meat populist attack. Do you think that it resonates with swing voters?
Well, I do think it resonates with swing voters. I think conservatives and liberals alike are a little bit perplexed by the size of the bailout. And it seems preposterous to me that in the midst of negotiating with the United States government, not only with AIG, but Goldman Sachs and others, that these people could run up such a tab and then still have their hand out to the federal government for assistance. I do think this warrants a closer look by the Treasury Department in an investigation, but it was a good moment for Obama to play on the populist theme that he's been expressing. And sadly, the economic malaise that seems to grip this country is to his political benefit. I only wish that both candidates could put partisan politics aside and find a meaningful solution, one that will work for the American people, rather than using the financial crisis as one where they can play to their respective bases for votes.
Mary, there was a lot of discussion about health care and different perspectives these two men have on how health care should be delivered or whether it is even a right or a responsibility. What did you hear in that debate that's useful for the American people to understand?
Well, I think they both did what you would expect, is they exaggerated the difficulty of the other guy's plan. and then lauded how great theirs was. But if you really have a choice here, and if you believe that there ought to be eventually a government-sponsored health insurance for most people, then the Obama plan would get you somewhere along the way toward that. It's not a universal health care in the way that was talked about during the primaries. But it would start up with money being given. Employers either have to provide it for you or they have to pay into a pool so that you can have insurance, and that parents have to provide insurance for their kids, otherwise there's a penalty. So it would be sort of like a Medicare solution to the problem. And if you think that that's the way we ought to go with a government plan, you got it. If you think you ought to go with a private sector plan, and it's hard to say anything good about the private sector nowadays, even though most people work for it, given all the financial problems, then McCain gets you part of the way there because he'll give a tax credit and you can go out and buy whatever kind of insurance you want. And he even wants you to be able to buy it across state lines, go to some other state and buy it and get it as cheaply as possible, and that you think there will be competition and that you think you might get better health care and be less costly to the government. So there is a clear difference between the two plans, and each person can take their choice.
I want to move on to foreign policy. Let's listen to an exchange that the candidates had about that.
Teddy Roosevelt used to say, walk softly, talk softly, but carry a big stick. Senator Obama likes to talk loudly. In fact, he said he wants to announce that he's going to attack Pakistan.
Senator McCain, this is the guy who sang Bomb, Bomb, Bomb Iran, who called for the annihilation of North Korea. That I don't think is an example of speaking softly.
Ron, what does this say about the two candidates' approaches?
Well, I think what we heard last night, I still think this is the greatest area of vulnerability for Senator Obama, is his seeming lack of experience as it relates to foreign policy. It is true that Senator Obama said that if, in fact, there was a reason to make an incursion into Pakistan, that Senator Obama would support that. Notwithstanding the fact that Pakistan is a nuclear power, notwithstanding the fact that Pakistan has been a loyal ally in the war on terrorism, I think that was an irresponsible comment. And I think Senator McCain was effective when he also went after Senator Obama as it related to his understanding of the surge. For many, many, many months, Senator Obama was unwilling or unable to say that the surge had worked in Iraq and that it had turned around our fortunes in Iraq. And instead, Senator Obama kept talking about Afghanistan and losing the ball and losing sight in Afghanistan. He's not in the military. He's not in a position to review classified information pertaining to intelligence. If only Senator McCain had hammered away consistently at those areas of vulnerability, I think McCain could have moved the needle. But he allowed Senator Obama to get by, and Senator Obama is very, very adept on his feet and was able to dance past it.
Mary, let me put this in the context of negative campaigning. There's a whole variety of attacks that are going on between campaigns, between supporters, in attack ads. One of them has to do with terrorism, which certainly is an aspect of how you understand someone's foreign policy. During a campaign speech in New Mexico, John McCain asked the crowd, who is the real Barack Obama? An audience member shouted out, a terrorist, and McCain did not challenge what the man said. Do you think it was an obligation on him to challenge that if he heard it and if, you know, he didn't believe it?
Well, I would prefer it if all candidates would challenge things like that when they're said. We had during the primary season people getting up in the audience and calling people names and saying things about Clinton and others, and no one said anything. We've had people getting up in the audience when Sarah Palin is speaking and saying negative things about Obama in ways that they shouldn't have been saying them, in my opinion, because they sounded like threats. And the candidate doesn't say anything. I think that it would be nice if the candidate would, but candidates don't. And the reason why they don't is because it's a perpetuation of their negative advertisement. If they lead people to believe certain things, then they get a response. It's like a call and response. The person got up and said something which echoed what they were saying, and therefore they can ignore it and either pretend like they didn't hear it.
Ron, let me ask you about some of the the negative attacks around Senator Obama have been centered around recently William Ayers, who helped organize the Weather Underground, and it was blamed for several domestic bombings. He's now a professor in Chicago, Ayers is. And Obama had encounters with him during the beginning of his political career, but they have been made much of by Sarah Palin, Governor Sarah Palin. Is that fair?
I think it is. I think when you're looking at the individual who'll be the next president of the United States, it goes to their character and their question. You certainly didn't hear a lot of the Democrats criticizing the Washington Post and other outlets when they had a story that alleged that Senator McCain had had an affair with a lobbyist, and a story that was proven to be false. Here you have an association with William Ayers, a member of the Weather Underground, a American terrorist, a group that was responsible for bombing the Capitol, bombing a wide variety of targets around the United States. And William Ayers only got off on a technicality because there was evidence that had been illegally obtained. But he was unrepentant. On September 11th, 2001, Mr. Ayers said that he had wished that he had gone further and that there were associations going back with Senator Obama. Senator Obama even wrote the foreword to a book that Mr. Ayers put out. Senator Obama's coming out political party when he ran for the state legislature was at Mr. Ayers' house. So I think legitimate questions to raise as it relates to
Mary, Ayers. Mary, we've got a nanosecond here, but please do weigh in.
I would just say that I think what the Obama campaign should do is they should just say, yes, we knew him then, and yes, we know him, and that's what he used to do, and it has nothing to do with me and what I do. And the guy has a lot of credible things about him, and move on rather than trying to deny it, because there's nothing wrong with knowing a guy who used to do something who isn't doing something now, and it's better than just letting the thing be perpetuated out there.
All right, guys, thanks so much.
Pleasure as always.
Thank you, Farai.
That was Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joined us from the studios of the University of Pennsylvania. We also had Ron Christie, former special assistant to President George W. Bush and president and founder of Christie Strategies. He joined us from HQ in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You've heard it before. It's the economy, stupid. But with the stock market's decline, the bailout plan, and all the bank closures, it takes smarts to understand what it means. We brought in a man who can take big ideas and crunch them down into single-serving sizes of information. Sean Flynn is an assistant professor of economics at Vassar College and the author of Economics for Dummies. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
So some economists say that you can take the country's economic temperature by going to the mall, so to find out how Wall Street is affecting folks' ability to shop. We checked in with a shopping crowd. Here's a little bit. We asked people, now understand that we were talking to them outside the mall when the wind was blowing. So, you know, that said, here's a few different voices. The first is from Abadule Dio from Los Angeles. He's talking about how the crunch affects him.
I usually use my line of credit to meet payroll sometimes, or to make some expenses. Like I'm changing the air conditioning in my office, and I was counting on a loan. I used to use sometimes my home equity line to tie me up in the business because I've been cut off too. So it's really hard in the bank.
So just to reiterate what he was saying, he was talking about being a sole proprietor of a business, a medical office, and his loans, I mean, his line of credit has been cut. He is having patients who basically cannot pay him anymore because they're losing their insurance. So he's caught between a pillar and a post. Will this bailout plan help him?
Yes, absolutely it will, but unfortunately it's going to take a little while, and economists right now are quite terrified that exactly what's happening to him is how this financial crisis on Wall Street is going to end up on Main Street. You have to remember that, you know, for new business starts, something like 70% of new businesses in America are started by people taking out loans against equity in their homes. And that market's completely dried up. Lines of credit, like for this gentleman, have completely dried up. And so, yeah, there's real fear that that's going to be a problem. As you may know, yesterday the Federal Reserve in the commercial paper market, which is essentially loans for businesses, a little bigger than this guy's businesses, but, you know, businesses with 20, 30 people, they had to go in and actually start making the loans directly because with all the terror on Wall Street, no one's lending to businesses of that size anymore.
We also had Dr. Diop also had a question for you.
I run a small business, and my line of credit has been cut off. with no reason. My credit is good, and I want to know what the program is doing to help restore credit small businesses.
So we talked a little bit about that already, but, you know, his concern is, you know, how's he going to get his credit back?
Well, the problem right now isn't his credit per se. It's the fact that the banks are completely terrified of lending any money. The banks right now are under huge scrutiny and pressure because no one knows which banks are holding what toxic assets. And the banks are basically hoarding cash right now because each of them is afraid of a bank run. They're all afraid that rumors will get out that they're the bank that's in big trouble and that everyone will come to withdraw their money. And, of course, as you know, banks, the way they make money is they take deposits from us and then they lend them out to someone else, which means that, you know, there's not that much money in the vault at any given time, so that if everyone rushes to the bank on a rumor that the bank's about to go bankrupt to try and be the first one to get some of that vault cash, the whole bank can collapse just on a rumor. So what the banks are trying to do right now is hold on to as much cash as possible to try and reassure people that there's no need to run up and that there's cash in the vault. But what that means, though, is they're not lending. And so it's not the case that this guy's credit is bad. Everyone knows that this guy's running a good business and he's always paid on time. It's the fact that the banks are afraid for themselves that if they lend him the money, they're not going to have any cash in the vault, basically. It's really, really unfortunate.
Explain to me how the cash in the vault issue and the FDIC insurance tie together for consumers. Is there, it sounds like there could be a moment where you walk up to your bank and there's just no money to give you, but then do you get it back later if there's federal insurance?
Yes. So the way it works, and they raised the limit. So it used to be $100,000, but now all your checking account deposits, savings account deposits, any money you have at a bank in the United States is now insured up to $250,000, which is more than most people have, obviously, in the bank at any one time. So that should reassure people, but it's still the case that you're right. The government's guaranteeing it, but what would happen if there were a bank run, if everyone ran to, and I don't want to give the name of any particular bank as an example because I don't want to cause any problems here, but if everyone ran to a particular bank to get their money out, they would run out of vault cash that day. And then the feds would have to come in and give the insurance money out. And so what actually happens is the government will write you a check directly if the banks can't pay, but it could take several weeks. Which is also still a problem with the system, because if people are afraid, oh my goodness, if I'm not the first one to get there and I won't get my money for 2 weeks, I want to make sure that doesn't happen to me. I still want to be the first one to get there. So it doesn't completely prevent bank runs the way the insurance works, but it definitely mitigates them and reduces the likelihood. But still, banks are so afraid right now that a bank run might happen, they're just not lending to anyone.
What about the whole idea of money under the mattress? I know that this is one of these things folks say, no, you're never going to get any interest with your money under the mattress. But right now, people are losing money in the market every day, and people who don't have any direct investments have them through retirement funds. So considering that the banks could run out of money temporarily and that the market is falling, is there anything to be said for literally putting money under your mattress?
I would say that you should only do that to the extent that you need to bridge those 2 weeks or 3 weeks till the government insurance comes in. The last thing I want to do here is encourage everyone to pull out all their money from and put it under the mattress, because that would cause a bank run, right, if everyone ran to do that. But absolutely, I think people should have some money, you know, make sure it's in a safe or something, make sure it's a secret. You don't want any burglars or prowlers figuring out that you got a large amount of cash on hand. But I think, you know, for just prudence, maybe a couple of weeks, that would be reasonable to me. But again, I don't want to encourage people to like think that the banking system is completely insolvent. Your deposits are insured. The worst thing that could possibly happen here is you couldn't get at some of your money for about a week or two. And actually, it might be shorter than that, because I know I have some friends working at the Federal Reserve, and they're prepared. They're actually trying to make sure that if any bank has a bank run, they'll be able to get the insurance out quicker than that, quicker than the kind of 2 weeks that it's traditionally taken. So, again, I don't want to encourage anyone to think paranoid or anything right now like that.
All right. Well, I want to reintroduce what we're doing. We are talking to Sean Flynn about the economic crisis using questions that we've gotten from folks who are out there listening, people on the street. Sean is an assistant professor of economics at Vassar College and the author of Economics for Dummies. And, of course, you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. And I am Farai Chidea. I want to go back to one of the people who we found at the mall. Her name's Lacey Cullum from Redondo Beach.
Well, I know the big thing right now is that the market's falling a lot. I don't know a whole lot about that because I don't actually have any investments or stocks or anything. I guess my big question would be, that mean to investments or to like a 401k or something like that?
So what's happening to 401ks?
Well, what's happening right now is they're taking a big, nasty hit. Probably the average person's 401k has fallen 25, maybe 30% in the last year. And just to sort of answer the beginning part of a question, basically what stock market values are, what you're purchasing when you buy, say, a share of IBM Corporation, is a share of future profits. And so the reason stock prices are falling right now is basically because most people, think that future profits are going to be smaller because they're expecting a recession, they're expecting this credit crisis to carry over into the real economy through channels like the gentleman who had the previous question, that his lines of credit are being cut. And so profit expectations are falling. Everyone's expecting things to get bad here. There's now talk of a worldwide recession, not just us, but Europe and whatnot. And so, prices are falling. And, 401ks, if you were mostly in stocks, you've seen that thing fall probably 25% in the last year or so.
I want to ask one more question about 401ks before I go on to talk a little bit about the world market, because that is something we're also interested in. I'm 39 years old. My mother is in her 60s. I have cousins in their 20s. Which one of us is facing the highest risk generationally at this time?
Well, this is going to cost us a lot of money. This bailout, it's potentially going to cost $1 trillion. So someone's going to be left on the tab for that, and it's just going to pile up as part of the national debt probably. So in that sense, younger people are more on the hook. I personally am hoping and thinking probably this will probably resolve itself in 18 months to 2 years. That's my hope. On the other hand, that's maybe being a little positive, but definitely not being negative. And so my hope is that within about 2 years, this will all be kind of behind us and mostly a bad memory. So, and if that's what ends up happening, then basically everyone will be okay except for the fact that the stock market might be 10, 15% lower than it otherwise would have been. But let me emphasize here, there's one other thing that's sort of looking at the broad financial picture. We're going to get a recession. Unemployment's probably going to tick up about 1%, maybe a little more. That's literally millions of people who are going to lose their jobs. You know, maybe not permanently, not for the rest of their lives, but for 6 months, 8 months, a year. And that to me is going to be the real human toll and what really matters here. The rest of us who don't lose our jobs are going to scrape by. We're going to be freaked out that our 401k is down by so much money for a few years before things recover. But it's the people who are about to lose their jobs that are really going to take this on the chin for all of us.
Let me go to the international markets issue because, you know, everything seems to be a huge interconnected mass right now. For example, some of the European nations were saying, get it together, America, before the U.S. passed the bailout plan, but their securities don't seem to be doing so well right now. What exactly is the ricochet effect going on right now between U.S. markets and the U.S. financial situation and other nations?
Well, in one direction, there were, you know, we had a big asset price bubble here. We had all these bad mortgages issued, and then people were issuing fancy securities based on whether or not those mortgages would pay off, and now a lot of them aren't paying off. The Europeans bought a lot of those, so they're holding a lot of the toxic waste right now, and that's hurting them. But a thing that has to be remembered here is that this asset price bubble, this land bubble, the housing price bubble, that just wasn't in the United States. There were actually bigger housing price bubbles in England and Germany, Australia, and other countries, and there were also many, many dubious loans made over there that are also now being defaulted on. And so it's going both ways, and it certainly, as much as European politicians might want to blame this on the United States exporting its problems over there, they've had bank failures too. They've had financial firms go under, and a lot of it was domestic over there, domestic in their countries. That being said, now going forward, it's unfortunately the case that Europe's economy has slowed significantly faster than ours, which is probably going to hurt us in that, you know, for the last year or two, with the dollar being so weak, it really was our exports to foreign countries, because from their perspective, with a weak dollar, that allows them to buy a lot of our stuff. That was really carrying the economy here in the United States. So now, if they're weakening, they're not going to be buying a lot of our stuff, and that's going to hurt us.
Speaking of buying stuff, in a consumer economy, there's a lot of people who rely on folks who want things versus need things, like they want to go out to dinner. So let's take a listen. We have once more from the mall, Mary Miles, and she's from Long Beach, California.
I haven't seen any major changes I think we're not going out to dinner as much. I know I don't. I used to love to go out. I don't go out to dinner as much as I used to, so I'm learning how to cook all over again.
Learning how to cook all over again. That might be good for her, her waistline, you know, the local farmer's market. Who's it bad for?
Well, local restaurants, obviously. And you know, in my area here, Vassar College is up in Poughkeepsie, New York, a little bit north of New York City. I've talked to local restaurateurs, and they've definitely noticed it. Also, there's been a shift, you know, towards people going out to the local diner, which is less expensive than to the fancier restaurants and things like that. And so, you know, just as a little anecdote along these lines, last Monday, a week ago Monday, when, you know, that was a really, really bad day on Wall Street, although there have now been many really bad days on Wall Street, for the S&P 500 stocks, every single one of them fell except for Campbell's Soup. So maybe,
comfort food.
Yes, comfort food, and maybe people thinking a good cheap meal will do well in a recession.
When you take a look ahead, there's been this cut in short-term interest rates. What does that really mean for people on the day-to-day? How does that ripple down?
Well, we're now getting into something that economists, it's a fancy term, like to call a liquidity trap. And the better metaphor is pushing on a string, right? If you're trying to move something, you know, you might tie a string to it and then you pull the other end, right? But if you push at the string, nothing happens. And so right now the Federal Reserve has the following nasty problem, and it's happened in several countries over the last 100 years, which is that even though the Federal Reserve is lowering interest rates, which is another way of saying it's making more money available to banks, because the banks can borrow at the Fed from the Fed at the low interest rate, and then what's supposed to happen under normal circumstances is they borrow at the Fed at the low interest rate, and they turn around and give the money to you at a little higher interest rate, and they make a little money on the spread there. But what's happening right now is the Fed's lowering the interest rates, But the banks aren't bothering to borrow much from the Fed because they're so terrified, as we talked about before, about lending to you and me, that even though the Fed is in some sense pushing on the string, trying to push all this money at the banks aren't turning around and making loans out into the wider economy. And so the Fed is kind of stuck here. And it's good they're doing everything they can. They're shoveling money into the banks as fast as they can. But if the banks don't turn around and lend that money, it's not really going to work very well. And that's why it's called a liquidity trap. The liquidity cash is floating around, but it doesn't seem to do anything. It's as though it's stuck in a trap, like a drain trap.
Right. Who's going to win? Who's going to win out of all this economic distress? Because somebody always makes money. So who's it going to be besides Campbell's Soup?
You know, the people who are going to make money here, and unfortunately, this is kind of like a lottery. If I knew exactly where and who, I'd make sure I was one of them. But what's going to happen here is because there is total panic right now, a lot of things that are worth more are selling for less, right? For instance, let me just say IBM again. I actually don't know what it's trading for today, but say it's actually worth $50 a share because it's got good profit prospects in the future and it's going to pay a lot of dividends. With the panic, it might only be selling for $35 right now. So to the extent that some people are going to come in and be willing to buy right now while everyone else is panicking and selling, they're the people who are eventually going to make some money. But on the other hand, that takes a lot of courage. And it also means you have to have access to cash right now because you can't buy anything, among other reasons, because you can't get a loan. You can't buy anything with other people's money right now. So pretty much it's people like Warren Buffett, who's been very conservative and had $10 or $20 billion in cash lying around in his company, Berkshire Hathaway's investment funds, who can go in right now. And, you know, he paid $5 billion for a large chunk of Goldman Sachs. He's going to end up making a lot of money out of this because the stock market had driven Goldman Sachs share price down unreasonably low in the middle of this panic.
Well, you know what? I don't have that $10 billion lying around, but I still appreciate the information. Thanks a lot, Sean.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sean Flynn is an assistant professor of economics at Vassar College. He is also the author of Economics for Dummies, and you can visit our website at nprnewsandnotes.org to get more financial tips from Sean. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We got Reverend Run from Run DMC to give us a crash course in family values on our blog, News and Views. Jeffrey Bennett can explain exactly what we're talking about. He's our web producer for News and Notes. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So we'll get to the Reverend Run's family in just a second, but what was the early response on our blog to last night's debate?
Well, we took a poll, as we often do. We asked simply, who won? 4% said it was a tie, 6% said McCain won, and 89% of those responding to our unscientific poll said Obama won. And we also have some reaction to some of the debate's more peripheral elements, like McCain calling Obama that one, and whether or not he shook his hand after the debate. So all of that's at our blog.
Yep, you have the you're going back to the video evidence.
Yeah.
So Rev Run and his wife Justine stopped by recently, and they're known now for their MTV reality show Run's House. Mm-hmm. Our cameras were rolling the whole time they were here. So how'd it go?
Well, it went well. They bickered a bit. I guess that's what marriage is, or so I'm told. But here's a clip.
Are you the opposite of how you were in terms of your behavior?
No. There was no. Yeah. No, I won't say that because behavior
means. Well, you don't smoke and drink.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay. What he mean when you say
opposite. That's what he
means. I'll answer it.
I was helping him.
You know, let me handle it. All right. Behavior meaning, if it comes to do I smoke weed still? No, but that's not what I'm talking about.
So the point of that. The point of that was not whether or not the man still smokes weed. The point was that, you know, the eye rolling and the teeth sucking, that's best conveyed on video, right?
I know,
so that's on our blog and on our YouTube channel, NPR News and Notes video.
I could hear that, the sound of a clean tooth. But, you know,
yeah,
but I can't wait to see it.
Neck rolls happening during that excerpt. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, neck rolls, I think, a good exercise. Anyway. Switching gears, Democratic strategist and News and Notes contributor Donna Brazile made a cameo on our blog. How'd that happen?
Well, yeah, over the weekend, she participated in a political forum hosted by The New Yorker, and she made news for her impassioned closing remarks. She was addressing whether or not Barack Obama's race will keep him from winning the White House. So here's part of that.
Yet we're having this conversation because he's biracial. He was raised for the first 18 to 21 years by his white grandparents. He ain't spent no time in living rooms like I spent my childhood. And yet he got out of school, went to Harvard, and all of a sudden he's uppity and something is wrong with him. What is wrong with us to suggest that some kid can't go to Harvard if he's earned the grades to go there? I tell my friends, you may vote against him, but don't ever put me back in the back of the bus. I'm not going to the back of the bus. I'm not going to be afraid anymore.
Makes me want to sing a spiritual or something. Mm-hmm. Not going to the back of the bus.
Donna always brings it. And so lastly, you blogged about a racial incident on the campaign trail. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, we got into a report by Dana Milbank of The Washington Post, who wrote about an incident involving a Palin supporter at a rally in Clearwater, Florida. Palin was delivering her stump speech, and she went on a rant against the mainstream media, and a person there said to a black TV sound man, called him a racial epithet, and then said, "Sit down, boy." So we have some more about that and other such troubling incidents on our blog.
All right. And I'm going to be posting a countdown. I'm going to talk about Russell Simmons, just spoke to him, and posted something yesterday, starting at the 28-day mark.
There we go.
Got to do something every day. It's the countdown. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jeff Bennett is our web producer for News and Notes. He joined me from the studios of NPR West. It is time now to see what other stories are heating up the internet. We've got today's Bloggers Roundtable. Win, lose, or draw. The bloggers get the chance to weigh in on last night's presidential debate, plus the so-called Bradley effect. Is it real, and could it impact the presidential election? With us, we've got the self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston. He's a blogger for sites including the Huffington Post and also writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. Lenny McAllister, a political contributor for the website Fox News Rising. He also blogs at Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. Plus, Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Good afternoon.
So we've had two debates so far, one to go. The presidential contenders John McCain and Barack Obama met in Nashville. And we heard earlier in the show that the town hall debate was moderated by Tom Brokaw. The questions came from voters. I'm going to start with you, Lenny. What stood out to you in terms of something that really was informational for someone who wanted to learn more about politics? It wasn't just windbagging, but what point do you think came across from either candidate that was useful information?
I think the number one thing that stuck out to everybody was the plan that John McCain is trying to put forth in regards to homeowners, where the Treasury Secretary, the proposal is for the Treasury Secretary to buy these bad mortgages in an attempt to stabilize the housing market. That was something that caught everybody off guard, and it made news. Now, as to whether it would play out and really work or not, will have to be seen. And I know that Mitt Romney made some comments on it last night on Fox News, and there will be more information coming from that. That was probably the number one big piece of meat, if you will, for folks to chew on. But the other thing that was there that was less about policy and more about substance as far as the candidates are concerned and image was just once again how Barack Obama contrasts with John McCain and how John McCain is not measuring up to looking presidential when those two are sitting side by side, despite the fact that he's been in the Senate for almost 30 years.
Felicia, what do you think about the idea that attitudes and physical stature. I mean, people have said for a long time that tall guys have it easier when running for the White House. Statistically, that's proven to be true. Do you think that Senator McCain is not looking presidential when he stands next to Senator Obama, as Lenny just said?
I would agree with that 100%. I don't think he's coming off as looking presidential. Last night, at times, he was coming off as being snarky, and Senator Obama kind of gave a cool, calm, and collected presence for most of the debate. And as you mentioned before, it is important. We do like to see our leaders, we like to see them composed. We like to feel like, you know, they're in control and that we're okay. And at times, I think Senator McCain does struggle with putting forth a presidential air and not so much of just an angry old man air.
Baratunde, you know, sometimes it's hard to parse out where you should focus just on policy or where you talk about rhetoric. But there's something that Senator McCain said last night that has some people upset. Let's take a listen.
You know who voted for it? Might never know. That one. You know who voted against it? Me. I have fought time after time against these pork barrel, these bills that come to the floor, and they have all kinds of goodies and all kinds of things in them for everybody, and they buy off the votes.
There was a phrase in there, that one, referring to Senator Obama. Some people took it as just debaters debating. Some people took it as dismissive but not racial. Some people took it as dismissive and racial. What did you think, Baratunde?
Well, first of all, I plan to vote for that one. I think that one has a better plan to lead this country in our great time of need right now. I didn't take it as racial. I took it as a consistent dismissal and really annoyance factor that McCain seems to project with regard to Senator Obama. The last debate, he would barely look at him or refer to him by name at all, and that doesn't look presidential. McCain is very fond of talking about all the things that he might do and even that he may have done. He says fixing Social Security will be easy. Well, if it's so easy, I'm not sure why he hasn't done it since his 26 years up there or more on Capitol Hill. As far as what Lenny brought up with the homeowners plan, I just want to update that information a little bit. It wasn't a new proposal by John McCain. In fact, Senator Obama and many other senators had proposed something, that exact plan, a bit earlier. So I don't know that he could really take credit for introducing that into the realm.
Lenny, any response?
Well, number one, the two parts, the first part of what Baratunde brought up was it's John McCain's grittiness would come across better if this were a football game. You can have that little bit of adversarial nature towards your opponent, but when you're having a presidential debate, people not only are longing for a change as far as how we do things, but they're looking for statesmen again, and that's one of Barack Obama's big appeals, is that he can come across as a statesman, and people are looking for pride in their politicians right now, as well as policies that work. And when John McCain does those type of actions, it further contrasts the image of Barack Obama being a great statesman and John McCain not being as good of a statesman. Now, when it comes back to the plan, this was something that Senator McCain had said for the first time himself in this debate. It was something that people weren't expecting, but it was a move that Senator McCain needed to make in order to appeal to the middle class, because it was true during the first presidential debate, he did not speak directly to the middle class. So this was something that, although the plan may have been out there in various forms previously, it was something that the McCain-Palin ticket had to put out into the atmosphere and put into the discussion in order to talk directly to the middle class and hope to try to get some of those voters back on their side.
All right, let's move on to go ahead.
I'd like to chime in on that one comment really quickly. I thought it was absolutely disrespectful, and to me it was almost along the lines of calling someone boy or saying you people, and it showed kind of desperation to me on Senator McCain's part. It was a situation where you're down in the polls, you don't know what to do, you're lashing out, and you're losing composure, and that's not a good look for anybody looking to be the chief executive of the country.
All right. Let me just move along because I think this will tie together with what you guys are just talking about. I want to bring race in more explicitly. And there's something called the Bradley effect. It's a tendency among white voters to not show as strong a support at the polls for a black candidate as they do when they are being polled before the election. It's named after former black mayor Tom Bradley, who was leading in the polls for California governor before the election but lost the race. Other people whose names come up, Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, who was running against Jesse Helms, Doug Wilder. People think that the Bradley effect is something that is real, but not everyone. Felicia, what do you think?
I think it's real. I do think it's real. And I think that after the 2000 elections, we're going to see any number of academic papers and studies looking at how it will have impacted this race. It's hard to say now. I think where it's going to play out the most will be in some of the states where it's going to be really, really close. And you'll have that percentage. It's just going to be so hard to tell right now how much of an effect it's going to have. But just judging by the various comments that have been made at the rallies lately with the racial tones, the feeling that a lot of people have that the McCain camp, unfortunately, is kind of taking the tack of attacking character and trying to appeal to the, I guess, some of the more base opinions of people. It's going to all play out. It's just a matter of to what degree it will play out.
There's also a New York Times columnist, Nicholas Kristof, who wrote that Senator Obama is facing what some people call racism without the racist. Most of the votes Obama could lose are not those of racists, he says, rather, quote, well-meaning whites who believe in racial equality and have no objection to electing a black person as president, yet who discriminate unconsciously. And it goes on from there. Baratunde, what do you make of that thesis?
Well, I think, one, Obama's not a generic black person. And what was brought up in Kristof's article by the psychologist Phil Goff was that people, you know, on an individual level have a much clearer and more fair perspective than at these general subconscious attitudes. So the Bradley effect specifically may not play a stronger role now as it had before, because Obama isn't Bradley, he isn't Doug Wilder, we're in a different time, and he's got a ground game and a registration of voters which can really offset a lot of that. He competed in 31 states in the Democratic primary, and he outperformed all those polls. And if someone was going to lie about their racism, it might be more likely to be a Democratic voter than a Republican. Finally, back to what Felicia said, what concerns me much more than this Bradley effect is this appeal to fear, to vilification, to otherness that Palin and McCain are amping up in these really hate-filled rallies. When you can have somebody yell out, "Kill him," at a rally and nothing's done and the politician doesn't stop and say that's not the kind of country we live in, when you directly associate your opponent with terrorism, and we know what this country does to so-called terrorists, that is unacceptable, and it's not leadership, and it's wrong.
Lenny, do you think that Governor Palin or Senator McCain should have acted more strongly when there were indications that their supporters may have crossed a line in calling Senator Obama a terrorist, or there was also a racial incident that we spoke about where a news sound man was called a racial epithet at a Palin rally. Is it the responsibility of the McCain campaign to deal with some of this?
They're leaders, yes. And I don't know what else to really say about that. It's extremely disappointing to hear that, you know, one of our candidates, be it on either side of the ticket, would hear a comment like that and not just shut it down for a second and say, okay, look, time out. We're Americans, and we're living in 2008 where we have an opportunity where the oldest candidate ever to run for a first term in the presidency, a female vice president for the first time ever on a GOP ticket, and an African-American gentleman for the first time to garner a major party nomination are all running within the same election cycle. That should have been addressed, and it is unfortunate when that doesn't happen. And I think that, unfortunately, it also speaks to the larger problem that the GOP has, which is racial sensitivity. There are things that they overlook that I don't think it's because they're racist. I think they're just ignorant to what the new realities of race and gender are in the 21st century. And unfortunately, for Republicans nationally, they're going to learn a hard lesson by way of the polls in November.
I have to throw in one last issue that we didn't get to on Monday, which is O.J. Simpson. And I bring this case up simply because this has been a Rorschach test of race in America. This was, he was convicted on several counts over the weekend. Here's one juror speaking out about what she sees as stereotypes about the jury.
Just from watching the media, we've been painted as an all-white jury that hates O.J., and that's just not true. it can be further from the truth.
Felicia, do you think that this, as we are talking about how people's attitudes play out, that this case and this man is this a situation where people will always be divided on whether justice was served, or is this a case where you think blacks and whites agree justice was served through his convictions?
I think that people will be divided, but to be perfectly blunt and honest, I think most people just want OJ to go away. Just really to go away. I think in going through all that he went through with that first trial, to me, whether he was innocent, guilty, whatever, I would be behaving like a choir boy. You would never catch me. You would never have the suspicion of me doing anything. So whether or not this jury did kind of convict him on the preconceived notion that he was guilty before and he shouldn't get off this time, we'll never know the answer to that. But to me, the bigger issue is, I don't want to say why do we care about OJ, because it is an important issue, but there's so many other things that are going on that are much more important than OJ.
All right.
Him in that same listing with Britney Spears.
Okay. Well, on that note, we got to wrap it up, so I didn't get much time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Felicia Harvey, editor of Black Politics on the Web. She was at member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Baratunde Thurston, who blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics, was at NPR's New York studios. And political analyst Lenny McAllister, he blogs for several sites including Hip Hop Republican, The Root, and AOL Black Voices. He was at member station WDAV in Davidson, North Carolina. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org.